Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Friday. It's January 8th. We've got 12 degrees here in Old Town Park City. No call-in from the Weather Center. So according to the National Weather Association, we've got increasing clouds for today. Right now, we've got mostly sunny skies, it looks like, with a high of 34 by this afternoon, though those clouds moving in with snow likely by tonight at about 11 p.m. We'll see an overnight low of 18 and maybe an inch or so, let's hope so, with snow showers tomorrow. We've got then high pressure rebuilding by Sunday with sun and highs into the mid-30s through, it looks like, Thursday. On the phone with us now from Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, I've got Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Sorry to disappoint you. This is Greg.
Well, Greg, I knew that. I had it. Thanks. Hi, Greg.
That's okay. Good morning. We had avalanches all week long. We had two additional human-triggered avalanches yesterday. One was in Martha's Bowl. This was a backcountry between Brighton and Alta. Northwest aspect, 10,000 feet, 3.5 feet deep and 300 feet wide, and the debris was 4 to 5 feet deep in places. We also had yet another avalanche along the Park City Ridge line, this one at Scott's Bowl, northeast aspect, 10,000 feet, 2 feet deep, 150 feet wide, so two large avalanches. Recent avalanches are the greatest indication of an avalanche danger. And since the new year, there have been more than 20 human-triggered avalanches failing in our very persistent weak layer that have been reported to the UAC since January 1st. Many of these have been triggered remotely, and as I was just saying, the ones yesterday, we're seeing them over 3 feet deep and up, over 150 feet wide. Recent storm snow this past week and moderate to strong winds have created this dense slab on top of this weak layer. We have dangerous avalanche conditions, so you simply need to avoid steep terrain facing west through north and east at the mid and upper elevations. So we're going with a considerable avalanche danger on the mid and upper elevations, then west through north and east. Keep in mind, if you're listening to public radio on your drive-in, you're considering going to a resort today. If you go through a gate, you're entering the backcountry and likely stepping into a considerable avalanche danger. And if you see previous tracks on a slope, it's zero indication of stability. It doesn't really mean anything. And lastly, if you're skiing or riding alone, you have no margin of safety. So if you're involved in an accident, there's no one to perform a rescue. So we've had a lot of close calls and near misses this past week, and a little fearful our luck has run out. So please keep it safe, folks. Got to stand at low angles and just avoid that steep slopes west through north and east. And that's about it for now. Yeah, a few inches of snow perhaps overnight.
Yeah, let's hope so. Hey, regarding the Scott's Bowl slide, said it was triggered remotely. Any idea where the skier was when that released? Were they below it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So fortunately, they were not involved in the slide. My guess is they were on an up track, and my guess is what they did was they triggered it remotely, so they probably got a collapse. It seems like they were safe where they were. They were in a safe area, a low-angled slope. But what it did was they got a collapse and it propagated to a steeper. I don't know exactly where they were, but from reading their observation, which we appreciate so much, it does seem like they're in a safe spot. The one in Martha's Bowl, that was a little spooky because the debris, which was 4 to 5 feet deep in places, actually covered portions of the skid track that they had previously been on. So they thought they were in safer, lower-angle terrain, but it was steeper up above them. So we're really advising people that you have to watch. Even if you're on lower-angled slopes, you have to make sure there's nothing steep above you.
Okay. Have a great weekend. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Later on, Park City Councilmember Nan Worrell with a recap of last night's meeting, really focused on the Arts and Culture District there. And nine-term Congressman representing Utah's 1st District, Rob Bishop, talks about his 18 years in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking to him at about 8:45. First, this holiday period apparently didn't break any visitation records, but demand across the country was solid. That according to a report from the Ski Area Management magazine. Even as conditions varied wildly from region to region, many North American resorts report a decent holiday season. The last 2 weeks of December was also the first major test of resorts' COVID-related policies. For most accounts, mask compliance was pretty good, although some areas did have to crack down. Here in Utah, the report says even with snow well below average, demand was solid. While a few resorts like Snowbird and Alta were completely open, many in the state had to deal with limited terrain. While natural snowfall was in short supply, temperatures were cold, allowing resorts to make snow. Ski Utah CEO Nathan Rafferty told Sam that mask compliance has been a major focus of the resorts, and while compliance is happening, it does take effort. The COVID-related messaging, he says, is sinking in with more using their cars as their base lodge. Guests are spending less on food and beverage than expected. Rafferty will be joining me on the Local News Hour next Thursday, January 14th, for a more in-depth conversation. News time, 8:12. It's 8:13 now. Good morning. Joining me now on the phone, I have Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Happy New Year. Let's see how things have started with the new year and what new applications may have come into the office.
Yeah, Happy New Year. You know, it's one of those situations where you take a wee vacation, a couple of days off for the holidays, and you come back and you look at your inbox, and it ends up looking like the floor of Nancy Pelosi's office. We got probably, since we talked last, over 24 new applications. So we're in the process of through those, and they do from everything from new plats to revisions to existing plats to move things like building pads around, low impact permits. Of note, one of them is a low impact permit for some test towers for the Echo Divide wind project. These wouldn't be the permanent towers. What they'll be doing is putting up these interim test towers to evaluate wind through the canyon, the best site, the proposed permanent towers that will be going out. So that's going to be a fairly substantial project. In Silver Creek Village, Habitat for Humanity is filing their final subdivision plat for their units being constructed out there. And so that's an exciting movement going forward. Wileman School is looking to do a small addition onto the back of their building. So a lot is coming in, a lot to keep us busy, but that's sort of the general flavor of what's come in since we talked last time.
Yeah, and then at the end of the last Stuyvesant Basin Planning Commission meeting, it was mentioned that you have received a use application for the Boyer Tech Park, apparently for a medical office building. Is this part of what's being developed or no?
So the existing project, the Tech Park, has a prescribed list of allowed uses and conditional uses. And we built in, I would say, probably going back about 6-7 years ago, a use determination process. Mm-hmm. So in the event that there was a proposed use that would go into the park that maybe needs a bit more study if it complies with that use table, that process is available. We did receive an application for use determination from Dakota Pacific. It is for medical facilities. I've assigned that to Peter Barnes to help shepherd through the process. The way that use determination works is an application submitted, a description is provided, and then the county manager, the planning director, community development director, and the chair of the planning commission sit down and do an evaluation and make a determination.
The determination, you know, one way or another is appealable to the council. I believe where it is right now is there was a request for additional details and information. They did meet on it. They reached back out. And I don't believe that we've received a resubmittal or that, not really a resubmittal, but that additional information on it. I can check in on that. Maybe we can talk about it the next time we have a chance to chat. But it would be allowed. I think the question is, with the proposed changes, is this something that can be done? And the answer to that is yes, because it's already built into the existing entitlement process.
Okay, so what would they get rid of then to build this? Or is this part of their retail that they had planned anyway?
Well, no, this would be part, this would be, if it was determined to be consistent with that use chart, it would just be part of that remaining, you know, 1.2 million square feet left to build out on the property. They would just move forward and build it. So, again, if it is determined to be an allowed or a conditional use, they would be able to do it by right. The process would be similar to what we went through when we built the Skull Candy building or the Chamber Bureau building. It'll go through a final site plan with the Planning Commission.
All right. Planning Commission meeting for the first time on Tuesday, I believe. What have you got big on there, or if anything?
Boy, we're cannonballing into the code amendments in a real substantial way. We're going to be taking a look at the commercial zones in the existing code. So that's going to be discussions on the neighborhood commercial zone, the community commercial zone, the service commercial zone. Those three land use districts haven't been seriously went through, I bet you, in a dozen years. So there's a lot to work through on that. I mean, everything in terms, do we need to go back and take a hard look at the uses that are allowed in those? Do we need to open them up a bit more? In some cases, do we need to take some out? So this will be the first time that the commission's had a chance to see some suggested changes put down on paper. Really, what we're going to be looking for is the feedback on that use table in those three zones. The other thing is that, you know, we want to make sure some of the design standards, the performance standards, exceptions for rooftop mechanical equipment and screening and those sorts of more detailed, you know, design considerations are consistent with some of the issues that we've been dealing with in the past. I know in terms of building heights and exceptions for screening, we've been working on that with the commission previously, but this is going to be a chance to go back and take a look at it from a more holistic point of view.
So what's the process here? I mean, do these commercial zones get discussed? The Planning Commission makes a recommendation and it moves on to Summit County Council? Or are we holding off on all of the amendments and then it comes to the council all at once?
The current strategy is to bring to the council the whole entire package rather than bring it in piecemeal. It's something that we've talked to council about during our last couple of joint sessions with them. So what the commission will do is we've got a program laid out that we reviewed with council. Some of the commissioners attended the meeting on Wednesday night. We got a program whereby we're going to work through sort of a schedule of both general plan and development codes. The target would be to get the general plan in front of the council by the first part of June, and the code portion of their work to the council by early August. Now, we're going to be doing the same thing with the Eastside Planning Commission as well. They're beginning the process of reviewing the general plan and going back and making some changes to the Eastside code. We had a discussion with the Eastside Planning Commission last evening on that as well. We're going to be sitting down with council for the Eastside work program on Wednesday the 20th. So There's a lot to do. Is it ambitious? Yeah, it's ambitious. I would call this our moonshot for 2021, but I really am confident that we can do it. Why? You know, I think we've got really strong guidance from the council on what they want to see and when they want to see it by. We've got really two excellent planning commissions, with real strong leadership. And we got the well-defined work program. So I think everybody is going to throw their best effort at it. What was helpful from the council was sort of their explanation. It may have been Doug Clyde who used the 80-20 rule. Oftentimes, you know, you spend 80% of your time on the last 20%. What the council is sort of reassured the commission, and they'll I think say the same thing to the Eastside Planning Commission, is, hey, give us your absolute best work. Give us that 80%. We're going to go through it ourselves. You know, there's going to be some additional public comment and editing and vetting, but give us that 80% and we'll take care of the final 20. And I think, you know, letting us all off the leash on that, I'm pretty confident we're going to deliver and, you know, by the end of the year, have two general plans that are updated and two codes that are better refined to deal with, you know, some of the vision that comes out of those plans.
So is there any thought of doing a temporary zoning ordinance until the work gets done, or is that really not necessary because it's not a density issue here? We're just talking about use.
You know, that's an excellent question. There hasn't been any specific discussion on sort of a broad macro temporary zoning ordinance. At this point, I don't think there's been a compelling reason to do that. Now, as soon as that comes out of my mouth, you know, we move forward in the year and maybe something comes up that would, you know, force us into that, you know, discussion of that. But right now, I don't think that that's going to probably be a necessary step because I think, like you just said, Leslie, none of this is really a density issue. More of it is just a refinement of the code, closing up some of the gaps, and then getting into the codes and the general plan, some of the tools and the language that we need to help address some of the problems that we've gone through in the last couple of years. Clearly, we need to roll up our sleeves and make sure the definitions that we have in both codes not only are consistent with state code definitions, but address some of the issues that we've had in the last couple of years. We'll be doing that throughout the process. The way our schedules are work for reviewing these things, you know, the definitions fall towards the end. That's deliberate. You know, we'll be collecting those definitions through all those different chapters throughout the process. But at the very end of it, we're going to be matching the code that we're writing with the definitions and the language that we'll be using at the end. I like the fact that we'll do it both at the planning commission level, but end up with the council being that final filter, that final sieve.
So it sounds like also the plan is that you're going to hold work sessions at every meeting, 4:30 to 6, and then get to the regular agenda items like the Dakota Pacific AL.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, that's going to be the plan. Every meeting, there will be time carved out. So for the Basin Planning Commission, we start at 4:30. From 4:30 till 6 o'clock, it'll be entirely devoted to general plan or code rewrites. And, you know, the way we've got it set up right now is, you know, we're going to say 45 minutes each. You know, that's probably not a hard rule, but we want to allow time for both of them. You know, there may be general plan discussions that evening that they get through fairly quickly that allow more time for the code stuff. We just think that the way this is laid out, I think we can do this.
And kind of not really knowing what's to come. I mean, are there issues out there that are going to be controversial? And what are those?
No, I think this is going to be pretty straightforward. Just kidding. No, I think there's going to be a lot here that's going to spark a lot of discussion and deliberation and debate. On the basin side, you know, one of the early topics we're going to tackle are accessory buildings. This is one we keep bumping into on a reoccurring basis. And so I think that is going to bring a lot of people out. I think that there are solutions out there. I think that this likely isn't going to be a one size fits all. We got, you know, over a dozen neighborhood planning areas in the Snyderville Basin, and each have their sort of unique characteristics associated with it. And so I think we're going to try and do the best job that we can to balance some things. And what are we going to try and balance? We're going to try and balance the very, very strong desire to maintain neighborhood character. We hear that consistently. So that's going to be an important pillar that we're going to have to build. The other is going to be that, you know, there are probably reasonable uses that will go into sort of these accessory buildings that, you know, we need to find a way to accommodate. I think what we're going to try and do is find that balance between the neighborhood character and predictability, but not end up with an open-ended development code that allows for, you know, a proliferation of really large buildings that are out of scale with the neighborhoods that they're potentially going to be built in. And, you know, this is going to be kind of a challenge as we head into the late winter and the spring. We're still going to be operating on Zoom for a while. And so what we're going to be doing at a staff level is trying to find a way to get this information out to the neighborhood, get the information out to the HOAs, get their thoughts, their feedback, a way that helps us in a timely manner make some decisions and some recommendations at the commission level. So I think accessory buildings are going to be a big topic. I think we're going to go back and take a strong look at our critical lands and our riparian area recommendations. Water quality is going to be an important aspect on the west side. You know, talking about water, council wants us to see if we can deliver some strong recommendations on, you know, sustainability. And among that sustainability platform is going to be water and water conservation. So that will be a big one. I'm kind of hogging the west side. On the east side, what we heard last night is some similar desires on the East Side Commission. They want to have a discussion on, you know, beginning to establish some sustainability targets on the East Side, you know, some climate mitigation. Housing is big on their priority, economic development as well. Transportation and infrastructure, you know, we got the village overlay that we're going to be working on a regular basis. That's going to be a big one. And then we also heard that the East Side Commission wants to take a step back, particularly in terms of the general plan, and have a discussion on, you know, rural small town character and what that means and what the design of that means. And again, not inconsistent with the work that's going on in the village overlay. They'd like to take a look at historic preservation as well. That was another topic that was touched on last night. So we're going to be busy.
Yeah, sounds like it. Okay, I've got to get on as well. So thanks for your time, Pat.
Always. Thanks for talking to me, Leslie. Appreciate it.
Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Newstime, 8:30. 8:31 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour, a full 3 hours of last night's Park City Council meeting dedicated to further discussion of the Arts and Culture District. On the phone with a recap of the meeting, I have Councilmember Nan Worrell. Good morning, Nan.
Good morning, Leslie.
So two main aspects of the project were discussed, transportation and affordable housing. Let's start with transportation. Council compared plans for a new transportation layout at the site, one being a streamlined bus circulation system, partially underground, the other a more traditional layout with four separate street-level bus stops. Do you prefer one over the other?
You know, originally I was a big fan of the putting the buses underground and making a transit hub under the ground. I'm from Seattle, and it works really well there. And I thought, wow, what an exciting thing to add here. But last night, the staff did a really good job of going through why that plan wouldn't work. And it, first of all, it would require that we detour all of our routes through there. It was designed as a one-way loop, and the buses would have to follow that loop no matter where they were going. It would increase the number of hours and the mileage for each bus route. On a normal winter day, according to staff, it would be really hard for the buses to get back into traffic onto Kearns. I think many days it would be very difficult for the buses to get back into traffic on Kearns, especially, you know, if they were trying to make a left-hand turn to go back out there. Kimball Junction. And then they said the system would completely fail during Sundance because you just couldn't get the number of buses per hour underground into that center that we'd need to do. And it would also add some travel time because the exit with the one-way loop would be mixing buses and cars that were trying to exit the garage. So as exciting as the plan looked initially, it's doomed to fail according to what we were told last night by staff.
All right, so we're going with just the streamlined circulation system?
Well, that was a big part of discussion, and I think we still have some more to discuss about that. You know, they're looking at four at-grade stops, and each of those stops would accommodate about three buses. Would there be concerns on the council that the northbound bus stop on Bonanza, because people would have to figure out how to get across Bonanza over into the Arts and Culture District. And the last thing that we need is a bunch of people getting off a bus and trying to dodge through traffic to get over there because they don't either want to go back to where the tunnel is or, you know, and the tunnel kind of directs them the wrong way from the Arts and Culture District. So I think there's still some challenges to be worked out here.
Well, and certainly staff did mention how heavy the bus and pedestrian traffic is during Sundance. I mean, after this year, do we know that Sundance is coming back like it used to be? I mean, what if they decide that going online really works well and the event in future years is scaled way back? I mean, do we build for a Sundance 2020 or do we wait and see what the future will be after, you know, 2022?
Those are all excellent questions, and I think that, you know, if we had a crystal ball, we certainly would know. And talking to the folks at Sundance, they definitely consider Park City their home, and they're definitely intending to bring the festival back here as soon as they can. You know, things change, and I don't know the answer to, I guess I don't, bottom line is I don't know the answer to your question. I don't think anybody does.
Sure. But again, given, should Sundance return like it has in years past, does that mean that we would need another transportation hub at the Arts and Culture District to address this, or are those four separate street-level bus stops going to work?
Apparently they're going to work. I didn't realize that during Sundance there's up to 72 buses an hour that run, and so we would have to figure out how to accommodate that. Our transportation staff seems confident that the four grade-level stops would be able to accommodate that. But again, I think there's still a lot of discussion that needs to happen around this.
Yeah. And again, you brought up concerns about the pedestrian traffic there on Bonanza. Councilmember Tim Henney said having more people crossing the streets going to add to the problem of more congestion on the roads. Bridges and tunnels have been discussed at past meetings as a way to address it. So what are we considering now?
Part of the discussion didn't really get fleshed out as much as I think all of us would have liked it to. So I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to really look at hard and come back and talk about. Certainly there's been discussion about putting another tunnel under Bonanza. There's also been talk about a bridge. You know, the bridge idea has kind of gotten abandoned for the moment. It's just cost-wise, it's very cost prohibitive to do that.
Oh, a bridge is more than underground, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Hmm. Again, you also learned that only so much can be done as far as pedestrian crosses on Kearns Boulevard, and that's because of the cemetery that restricts how wide things can be on the north side of the road. So any ideas about how to get around that?
Transportation staff is looking hard at that, and they're going to be coming back with some more information for us. But it's certainly a challenge. Just like we talked about, there was talk at one point in time about putting a roundabout there, but the cemetery certainly put some constraints on how much wiggle room we have on that side of the street.
Regarding affordable housing, lots of discussion there, with city projections saying the costs could be upwards of $600,000 a unit. Mayor Andy Bierman said that is a reality test. And I'm not sure $600,000 is affordable for most people working in the resort business in Park City. So what's your take on the inflated construction costs since the initial estimates?
One of the things that I was really impressed with staff with last night is they laid it all out. And it was a very honest look at this is the construction cost. So the construction cost of a micro unit would be well over $600,000. And all of us took a big step back and a gulp and said, wow, that's a lot. And I think the majority of the council said that's too much. That's about twice what we normally build an affordable unit for. So we've asked staff to come back and really look to see if there's other ways that cost-saving measures or if those costs accurate. We also talked about the possibility of if indeed the construction costs on that parcel are going to be so high, we also own the Homestake area that we had designated for affordable housing. Is it possible to shift some of that housing off of Bonanza Park and over onto Homestake, which is basically in the same area?
Yeah. So would there be any difference in the cost of construction there as opposed to the Art and Culture District?
Staff seems to think so. Part of the reason that the cost of those units is going up so much is because of the parking. They have, the parking deck is right there and a couple layers of it are underground. And so that is helping to drive the cost of those units up. So if we moved those units over onto Homestake, on the back of the napkin math, like Steve likes to say, it looks like that would be a better thing. But, again, it's just another thing that we'd like to look at.
All right. So you didn't really agree on anything other than just to look at it.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm always also intrigued, as I have been with other developments, affordable housing developments that the city has done, is what would it take to bring a private developer in here? Does the city really need to be the one that's always, building all the affordable housing? And there's a lot of challenges to partnering with a private developer, but I think that that's definitely something we might want to consider here.
Okay. What kind of incentives would you have to offer a private developer?
Well, that's the details that would have to be looked at. In the past, developers have wanted more density, if they've wanted more height, or, we got an email recently from a resident that had some kind of creative ideas of ways that the city might want to think about partnering with private developers. So, if we're putting everything on the table, which the council agreed last night we need to be doing, putting all options on the table, I think that's one that needs to come on the table too.
Also, some back and forth on who this affordable housing would actually be for. Should these units be for a single person, a couple, a young family? What's your thought?
My personal thought is that it's going to be a really busy district. We want this district to be vibrant. There's, going to be programming on the plaza, the Sundance has kind of a little amphitheater outside where films can be shown. There's going to be a lot of events on this plaza. So it's going to be a very vibrant part of the community. And I think that will dictate to some extent who wants to live there. Would I want to live in a really loud, vibrant community at night with a newborn baby? I probably would not. We look at the frictions between Old Town residents and some of the noise that goes on Main Street and in that area. And, I think that's a lesson well learned that we need to look at as we're thinking about who might want to live in these units.
And what I heard, I think, from city leaders was that we're planning to use these as rentals because that then supplies the funding for future affordable housing projects. But have we decided whether they're going to be for rent or for sale?
We have not. And last night we saw financial modeling. You know, I've got to give my hands up for our budget department, because they've really done an excellent job of looking at different models, looking at different ways that this might work financially. And I'm looking forward to our next meeting when we're really going to delve into the finances of this.
Yeah, and that was part of it. The discussion lasted too long to get to those financials. And it sounds like that may be the hardest aspect to get through. As of now, I mean, do you think the council is going to give this project the green light?
I think the council is working really hard to figure out how this project can go forward. I don't think it's a matter of if anymore. I think it's a matter of how can we make this the best project that we possibly can get for the community.
All right. Anything else from last night's meeting that you wanted to mention?
You know, we just had some, we have adopted our calendar for the next year, and that's certainly available if anyone who wants to mark their calendar for when we're going to be meeting. But if I could, I'd like to also mention that there is a small business and employee free rapid testing program that's going on. It's a partnership between the county, city, chamber, and the People's Health Clinic. And it's an attempt to get our employees back to work as soon as they possibly can. And so the governor has said that as long as people are asymptomatic and have a negative rapid test, they can get back to work in 7 days instead of the previous 14 that they had to be off work. So that gets people back to work a week earlier. So people can make an appointment and go and get a free rapid test to help them get back on the job sooner. And so far it's been really, really well received. And people can find out more information about that on the city's website, parkcity.org.
All right. Park City Council Member Nan Worrell, thanks so much for your time and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Newstime now, 844. KPCW Newstime now, 844. Good morning. Well, the two Utah congressmen who represent the Wasatch Back in the United States House of Representatives, John Curtis and Blake Moore, both spoke out against the violent insurrection at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
What is traditionally a largely ceremonial and uneventful procedure in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday descended into chaos as violent pro-Trump extremists breached the Capitol building and ceased the official counting of Electoral College votes in both the House and Senate chambers. Members of Congress were told to shelter in place and were issued gas masks by Capitol Police after tear gas was released inside the building. Congressman John Curtis, who represents Utah's 3rd District, which includes Wasatch County, he posted a video on his Twitter feed during the lockdown to say he and his staff were safe. He condemned the violence and called for everyone to, quote, dial it down.
It's just totally inappropriate what's happening outside the Capitol. It's not who we are. We're better than this. And please, let's use all of our influence to tone this down and get back to reasonable debate.
Later on Wednesday, Congressman Curtis released an even stronger condemnation of the events, characterizing the violence as, quote, an act of domestic terrorism inspired and encouraged by our president. He went on to say, quote, no American, no elected leader, and certainly no president who participates, inspires, or condones actions such as these has my sympathy or support. Newly sworn in Congressman Blake Moore represents Utah's 1st District and Summit County. Congressman Moore's office released a statement Thursday morning characterizing the violence as, quote, an assault on the United States Capitol and un-American. Congressman Curtis and Moore are both Republicans, but neither supported the objections by their colleagues, including those from fellow Utah Congressman Chris Stewart and Burgess Owens, to the counting of Electoral College votes. Moore continued in his statement to accuse Democrats of trying to overthrow the Electoral College, calling it a, quote, long-time goal of theirs. Bills have been introduced to Congress 3 times since 1969 to amend the Constitution and have presidential elections decided by the national popular vote instead of the Electoral College. None have succeeded. He continued, quote, I could not in principle object or vote to agree to the objection, but I promise that I will fight for every American's voice to be heard and every voter to have trust in our system. After the Capitol building was cleared of rioters, Congress reconvened early into Thursday morning and officially ratified President-elect Joe Biden's victory shortly after 2 a.m. Mountain Time. As of this report, 4 people have died from Wednesday's violence in Washington, D.C. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Newstime Now 847. KPCW Newstime Now 847. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as of last Sunday, Republican Congressman Rob Bishop ended his 18 years serving the 1st Congressional District for Utah. He joins me now on the phone with a look back at his long political career. Good morning, Congressman. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's good to talk to you.
So first, how are you doing? Of course, we've reported that you suffered a minor stroke. Are you fully recovered?
I know that's going to take a couple of months at least to do so. I was very lucky in the stroke. It is a minor one, but it has impacted my right side and my mobility. So I'm undergoing therapy for that.
Yeah. So would you have been up for a stint as lieutenant governor had Thomas Wright won? I mean,
I hadn't thought of that question, but yeah, I could do intellectually. I can still handle it. Yeah. I just wouldn't be walking a whole lot.
And why was that something you wanted to do after, you know, serving in the state house again, then moving on to Congress and then come back and be lieutenant governor?
Well, the first reason is that I thought that Thomas Wright would be the best governor candidate. He clearly had the background as well as the point of view and the mindset that a governor would need. I think he could come up with creative new ideas and actually be a force to move the state into another round of expansion and growth. At the same time, what he wanted me to do is really concentrate on about four areas that I found interesting and fascinating and to deal specifically with those concepts. And I thought that was a unique way of trying to work together in a partnership. And I was excited about that, especially those areas he wanted me to deal with are things of which I felt comfortable and really wanted to get involved.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, you left the nation's capital just in the nick of time. Can you talk to us about your reaction about what happened there in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol building on Wednesday?
What happened is sad is such an understatement. As I saw what was happening, is where I would work and walk and took tour groups all along. My heart sunk in what I saw taking place. It's going to be a while to sort out all the details of what was going on, but it is wrong. And it kind of added on to what I've been feeling all year long as I've seen other places which are important to me, or I spent some time here in Utah that were being under protest, that became violent. And actions that were taken that should never, never take place. So it was a very disheartening time as I watched what was going on back there.
Yeah. So are you one of those who think that the election was stolen from President Trump? Do we have a problem here with our election system?
Look, during the impeachment issue that was going on with Trump, one of the things I wanted is to say, if I was going to vote for that, I wanted to have firm evidence that what the president had done rose to the level of impeachment, and there was no actual firm evidence. A lot of accusations and smoke, but no evidence. I have the same situation here. Could there have been some manipulation of the election? Possibly, but there is no firm evidence of it. So actually, there is no reason to assume it sans some kind of actual evidence that illustrates that problems did take place with either the election or the registration process that was going on. I think what the president finally said yesterday was exactly what he should have said on Wednesday. And I'm glad he, at least what he said on said yesterday, that he finally did that.
Yeah. Senator Ted Cruz, of course, has been the one who thinks that we need to put together a commission to look into the election irregularities, as he puts it. I mean, would you have supported something like that?
Well, see, and that's a part of the issue that was debated on Wednesday, or started to be debated on Wednesday, was a twofold issue. There was a question on whether you certify the elections certification is responsibility of the states, and you take the state's word for it. But the other issue was, should there be some mechanism to go in there and look at what actually did take place in case you want to, in case there is some kind of irregularity that needs to be fixed going forward. And that's why whether one voted yes or no on Wednesday, you could justify it because there's basically two different questions that were being asked. Is there anything wrong with trying to investigate and see what actually did take place? No, there's nothing wrong with that. Have there been, if the complaints, though, are legitimate, there has to be some legitimate, realistic evidence of it. And to date, there is none.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Senator Cruz must have a short memory, though. I mean, because it was back in 2016, you know, when President Trump accused him, Cruz, of stealing the Iowa caucus. But, you know, moving on, though, let's look back at your 18 years as our congressman. Anything that you can say that you are most proud of?
You know, in the almost two decades that I was there, there are so many things that took place. As I'm going back there and starting to categorize and look through my papers, there's a lot of things that we did that never were high profile, and I was very proud of that. In fact, you know, Frank Pignelli always used to say that I was allergic to the media, and I never tried to run and make some kind of public pronouncement of what we were doing. But there are some things that I was proud of, especially in the areas where I was told I couldn't do it. And I found, or we found with my staff and others, we found creative ways to get around the roadblocks and actually accomplish some goals that I think helped Utah, especially Hill Air Force Base. And those make me proud. I also realized, you know, when I was in the state legislature before that, that it is so easy to get a big head about what you were doing. That my office is really kind of cool. I'm not. I'm just somebody that's occupying it. And when I leave, somebody else will take the place who may do it probably better than I. So not taking myself too serious was something I think members of Congress and members in any public office have to work to maintain that attitude. And I put a lot of effort into trying to make sure that I wouldn't let my staff call me sir or the boss. I insisted that I hold the door for them, that they didn't have to stand when I came into the room, which was a practice back in Washington I just found appalling. So an effort to try and make sure I didn't get a big head about this entire thing.
Yeah. Hill Air Force Base, I mean, that was something I know that you have fought over your tenure there to keep it from being defunded. With rookie Blake Moore in office now, is that something that can be easily grabbed away from us?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think Hill Air Force Base has improved over the 18 years that I have been there to the point that it would be financially impossible to replicate Hill Air Force Base somewhere else, and that Hill Air Force Base has proved its value to the military. It's highly ranked. It is a multiple, very complex situation that is not only a depot, but also a fighter wing. It has the research that's going on, munitions, exploration work that is going forward, as well as storage. It has computer work that's taking place. There are so many things that make it viable that I don't think it's in a position that has to be as fearful as it was when I first went back there. And we were going through a base realignment and closure commission that really could have been very troublesome. And the other thing, though, is I want to realize that I realize it's not necessarily what I did that helped save Hill Air Force Base. It was Hill Air Force Base itself. The quality of the workers that are there, the quality of the public support around that base, that is one of the things that stands out in fast contrast to bases in other states. And that is one of the reasons why Hill Air Force Base, I think, is more secure now than it ever has been and will stay that way in the future. It's Utah that made Hill Air Force Base the significant base that it is.
We often hear from elected officials that they re-up for another election because they don't feel like they were able to get the work done. Any disappointments that you had during your tenure that you weren't able to see through?
Well, yes, but can I talk about that philosophy first in just a second before I go into any specifics with you? That's true. there is always something more to be done. And I realized early on that if that was my mindset, I would never leave. I wasn't ready to go when I did. Physically, I was happy to go, but intellectually, there is still something that I would like to do. So I realized, actually back in 2010, that I had to realize if I didn't want to stay there until I died, I had to give myself a logical reason of when would be the right time to leave for the sake of Utah. And I anticipated that this was the right time, that in the 2020 cycle, my effort to be chairman of the committee would have been passed. Yeah, if I stayed there as a senior member, I could probably do more than a rookie. But what I would be doing is taking away somebody else's opportunity to gaining the seniority that would be necessary to help Utah out in the future. So back in 2010, I said, you know, 2018 will be the last time I run, whether I'm ready or not, because that is the right thing to do for the state of Utah.
All right.
I tried to look at it differently, and that's why I chose this particular time to step aside.
So what's next for you? It sounds like you may be pulling papers together for a book, perhaps?
You know, I've actually written something. When I went back to Congress, I looked at all the stuff that I was using in teaching advanced placement government classes in high school and the textbooks that I was using. And to be honest, I realized what I was telling them about Congress was basically wrong. Congress changes so rapidly by the time a textbook is actually written, most of the stuff is stayed boring and inaccurate. So I started writing down what were the kinds of stories that I wish I had had when I was actually teaching school about Congress and about the institution and its relationship with the Senate and the governors, the Senate and the presidency and the media and elections and everything else. So I've actually started that process.
Okay, so thinking that you might get back to teaching?
I would like to. With the stroke right now, obviously, it's going to be a while, a couple of months, just to be able to do something in that range. I've talked to a couple of schools, and I would very much like to do that, yes.
Okay, well, get well soon. Thank you for your service, and thanks for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's retired Congressman Rob Bishop, served the 1st District for Utah. It's 9 o'clock.
I'm Mike Kirby with Big D Construction, celebrating another great year with KPCW. Jack Livinggood had the vision 17 years ago to create a true mountain resort division, hiring people that live, understand, and build in the community. With offices in Jackson, Bozeman, and our home office in Park City, that vision is alive today. More information at big-d.com.
18 degrees now in Old Town Park City. Enjoy the morning. We're going to have some sunshine, snow moving in with clouds later this afternoon. A little bit of snow tonight. Tomorrow morning, back to sunshine and sunshine through next Thursday. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Time for news.